Hello and welcome to MailCare's Advanced Prostate Cancer Program teleconference. Founded in 1998, MailCare is America's largest and leading men's cancer survivor support and advocacy national nonprofit. MailCare's goal is to improve communication between you and your doctor by giving you the same language and understanding of your disease. Tonight I see that we have actually over 604 people are currently listening, and we're honored that you're allowing us to participate in your care. Tonight, you will be hearing Joel Nowak, MailCare's Director of Advanced Disease and Advocacy, and Dr. Neil Shore discuss the groundbreaking prostate cancer treatment, Provenge. Tonight's talk will last approximately 60 minutes and will be peppered with questions that you, the listener, emailed in earlier this evening and last week. Tonight's talk will also be recorded and available for listening at our website, mailcare.org, in our Advanced Prostate Cancer web section. Also, everyone here is invited to sign up for more information about our programs and our emailed newsletter, also at mailcare.org. Now, please give your attention to Joel Nowak and Neil Shore as they talk about Provenge.
Good afternoon or good evening, everyone. This is Joel Nowak. Before I get started with the teleconference, I want to welcome everyone, and especially Dr. Shore, who has agreed to donate his time with us this evening. Dr. Shore is the medical director of the Carolina Urological Research Center, as well as being on staff at the Grand Strand Regional Medical Center. Dr. Shore has conducted more than 100 clinical trials, focusing mainly on prostate and bladder disease, including the trials of Provenge. Dr. Shore is a board-certified urologist who has numerous publications in peer-reviewed journals and has lectured extensively on the treatment of prostate cancer. I want to say that we are very lucky and gifted, very fortunate to have him. And I do also want to say that after listening to this conference, if you have any interest in making an appointment to see Dr. Shore, who is located in North Carolina in the Myrtle Beach area, you may call his office at 1-877-809-8714. And now we're on to the conference. Good evening, Dr. Shore.
Good evening, and thank you for giving me the opportunity to address your audience.
It's our pleasure. This last 2 years, as you know, have been really exciting for those of us with prostate cancer. We have a lot of new drugs that have been approved by the FDA, and since it's been 4 or 5 years since we've had any other drugs, it's really a different era we're looking at. We have Jeftana, Degradelex, Nesnab, and Abiraterone, and of course, we now have Provenge, which is really the main topic of tonight's conversation. Perhaps if we have some time later on, we can go back to these other drugs, but I don't know if we will. So let's move directly on to Provenge, or stipple cell T. Could you please tell us what actually your involvement was in the development of this drug?
Well, yeah, so we have our own separate clinical research program called Carolina Urologic Research Center, and I started that about 10 years ago. I've been in practice in Myrtle Beach since 1997 in South Carolina, and I have 14 partners, 14 single specialty urologists. And having trained in a program at Cornell and at Sloan Kettering in New York, I was always very disturbed by the fact that we didn't offer as many things to patients with advanced prostate cancer as I saw in other solid tumor malignancies. And had the great fortune to work with some of the best medical oncologists as well as the best urologists there. And one of the things that was said early on in the introduction of the program, that if I'm a patient with prostate cancer, it's so vitally important to have your urologist and medical oncologist talking to each other, as well as the radiation oncologist. And I think programs like this are so important because they give the patient the ability to ask each one of their specialty treating physicians what options are available to them, and are their various specialists communicating well with each other. So in a long-winded way, I started my own clinical trials program over 10 years ago because a lot of the companies, biotechnology companies, pharmaceutical companies, were having a really difficult time enrolling patients and getting answers that we needed to have. You know, we've talked about this war on cancer. You see it in the front of the Time magazine. And why aren't we winning the war? Or maybe we are winning the war. And I think what you said, Joel, is we're starting to see some major advances in the battlefront. As you listed, you know, five new therapies in the last year alone, which is truly amazing. So my involvement with Provenge, or what the FDA describes as Sipuleucel-T, that's the sort of the generic name that they've given as a classification for this particular vaccine immunotherapy. We can talk more about that. Began in 2003, and I was an early investigator in the phase 3 registration trial, which led to FDA approval in April of 2010. So it took a full 7 years of that phase 3 trial, not including the earlier trials that began, you know, even before 2000. So it really took over a decade and over $1 billion to get Provenge approved and to the market. So I was the second or third leading accruing urology site in the country. There were 50 sites in North America. And being in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, I have a lot of retirees. About 70% of my populace is over 65. So we see a lot of cancer. And as everybody knows who's listening, as we get older, our risk factors for cancer increase with age and various other factors. But it wasn't hard where I am to find patients who I thought would benefit from consideration in the trial. So we were the third leading accruing site, and since it's been approved in April of 2010, I've actually infused somewhere about 30 additional patients with Provenge. I'm proud to say I was the third author on the New England Journal of Medicine article, which was published in July of 2010. For any of the listeners who want to look at that article, you can get a lot of the really great specifics and details of what the trial was that led to approval.
Terrific. Now, I know that Provenge is a brand new type of treatment. It's an immunological therapy. Could you actually explain what that means and why this is different from the other treatments we have available?
Sure. You know, traditionally, when patients have an advanced disease categorization, what does that mean? Well, for simplistic purposes or understanding, the disease has escaped outside of the primary organ of etiology, be it the breast or the colon or, in our case, what we're talking about, the prostate. And it wasn't until 2004 that we saw the approval of docetaxel, also known as Taxotere, which was a big deal because prior to 2004, we didn't have any systemic therapy to treat men with cancer that had progressed outside the prostate, that had also progressed despite suppression of the testosterone level. And that therapy, docetaxel, or also known as Taxotere, that's a chemotherapy. And, you know, simplistically put, virtually all the chemotherapeutic agents, whether they're for prostate cancer, breast, colon, lung, pancreas, et cetera, they're geared towards stopping cellular machinery in a way that we describe as being, we use the word cytotoxic. So the challenge with a chemotherapy or cytotoxic is it slows down or damages or destroys rapidly dividing cells, which neoplastic or tumor cells tend to be. The challenge is trying to avoid the normal rapidly dividing cells, such as the cells that line the gastrointestinal tract or the cells within the bone marrow, from being damaged as well. An immunologic therapy, to answer your question, is designed to stimulate the patient's own natural defenses, specifically the patient's white blood cells. In the case of Provenge or Cipulacel T is to stimulate the T cells, or what we call the natural killer cells, which can directly attack the tumor antigen, proteins on the surface of the tumor, to slow down the tumor and impact on the patient's overall survival. So this immunotherapy is sort of what one might think of it as being a smart bomb to destroy or impact on the tumor cell without impacting or affecting other healthy cells within the body.
I see. And sometimes Provenge is called a vaccine. So I guess the real question is, why don't we go around giving Provenge to everyone so that they don't develop prostate cancer?
Right. Now, that's a good question, and it's a source of frequent confusion for not just patients, but also for other physicians who are not normally following immunobiologics. So we tend to classify vaccine therapies as either therapeutic vaccine or a prophylactic or preventive vaccine. So the typical vaccine one might get, you know, say for measles, mumps, rubella, and childhood, or the childhood vaccines, those are designed to prevent a disease from ever happening. Provenge is not a preventative or prophylactic vaccine. It's a therapeutic vaccine, which means it's designed to help treat the disease, not prevent it, but treat it, and help impact on survival.
I see. And how does a man qualify, or what does he need in order to get Provenge?
So the Phase 3 trial, known as the 9902B, or the IMPACT trial — a lot of these trials always have numbers, and then they also have names that are typically acronyms for the overall title of the trial. 9902B means it was actually, you know, literally kind of brainstormed back in 1999. But having said that, in order to qualify for Provenge today, I think it's fair to say that virtually all insurance carriers, third-party payers, and most importantly, CMS, or the Medicare network of payers, are requesting that the inclusion and exclusion criteria of the Phase 3 trial that the FDA approved, that inclusion and exclusion criteria is followed. So what that means is the patients who were able to receive Provenge in the trial, and there was also an arm that didn't get it in the very beginning, which is typical of all Phase 3 trials. They're blinded and randomized, and there's always a placebo arm to make sure that the drug therapy has real statistical validity. But the inclusion criteria to be a candidate for the study was you had to have had a diagnosis of prostate cancer, had been on some form of testosterone suppression, typical drugs like leuprolide, and whether it's a 1 month, a 3, a 6, or a 12-month formulation, or have had surgical orchiectomy, enough to show that the testosterone level had to be very, very low. And not only in addition to that, the PSA, the prostate-specific antigen blood test, had to be showing 3 consecutive rises despite being on androgen deprivation therapy. So this describes a typical verbiage that we used to call hormone refractory prostate cancer, and then we started calling it androgen independent prostate cancer, and now we refer to this disease state in our nomenclature and in our clinical trials as castrate resistant prostate cancer, or the acronym CRPC, which means on hormone suppression, diagnosis of prostate cancer, and at least 3 consecutive rises in the PSA level from the absolute bottom, or what we call the nadir. And those levels are typically taken at least 2 weeks apart. And one additional very important caveat is radiologic evidence of disease. So what does that mean? It means the patients had to have had positive findings of lesions on bone scan or CAT scan, but yet still be asymptomatic or really minimally symptomatic. In other words, we didn't want to have patients in this study who clearly would benefit going right to chemotherapy. So in summary, what I just said was patients with a rising PSA on hormone suppressive therapy and a positive bone or CAT scan who were overall still feeling quite well with not much discomfort, and certainly not on any kind of narcotic analgesics.
I see. Now, for a man in today's situation who has a lot of pain, based on what you've said, they would not qualify, they would not be able to get Provenge and have it reimbursed. Is that still the case, or is there more flexibility these days?
I think overall, Joel, that is still the case. Number one, I think that for a patient who is having cancer-related pain, that they really would be better off receiving a cytotoxic therapy or a chemotherapeutic. The reason being is that it has a much more initial rapid onset of action. What we saw in the Provenge phase 3 trial is that the patients were asymptomatic, and the survival benefit started to be seen about 6 months after the infusion. And unlike a chemotherapeutic, you start to see the effect in terms of its impact on cells very, very quickly. And you see that because people also get impact on their normal cells. I know they get hair loss and diarrhea and things of that nature. And then once you stop using the chemotherapy, its effect is essentially over in a relatively quick period of time. This is a very, very important distinction, because with an immunotherapy like Provenge, it's only given in 3 infusions and over the period of about 30 to 40 days, and that's it. And its effect can theoretically last for the entire patient's lifetime. So it takes a little bit slower onset to have its impact, but yet it's good and remains within the patient's immune system in perpetuity. Very, very different from a classic chemotherapeutic cytotoxic effect.
Right. Well, that's interesting, and I'm actually going to skip ahead of where I was going to go and follow up on this. So you said that the positive results of Provenge will last for the rest of that person's life. So is there a need for boosters and so forth, or is it just going to be there forever?
In the study, the patients received only 3 infusions and it was stopped. And that was based on some earlier preclinical or in some animal experimentation models. So it was approved on the basis of just 3 infusions. And I can tell you that they're very simple to give, and they're extremely well tolerated. There's no impact on the gastrointestinal tract per se, like one would expect in a cytotoxic. Patients maintain their energy levels. There's no requirement to be on steroids. The pre-medication for receiving an infusion is Tylenol and Benadryl, simple over-the-counter therapies. And in the over the 50 patients I've treated with Provenge, I've never hospitalized anybody. So patients' quality of life is very well maintained. Having said that, your question is a key one in that, and it gets brought up a lot, is if they're doing well with just those simple 3 cycles given over a 30 to 40-day period, well, what ways can we measure the patient's cancer response or their immunologic response 3 months, 6 months, a year, possibly 2 years later, and would they benefit from any boost or additional maintenance therapy? And the very honest answer to that question is we don't know. And so those studies need to be accomplished.
I see. Okay. And, of course, I get a lot of questions, and I'm sure you do too, from men who have advanced disease, but they are in an earlier stage. And, their logic says, well, if it will work at one stage, if I get it earlier, won't it work even better?
Well, the stage that's most close in clinical proximity to what I described, you know, the guy's got to have a positive bone scan CAT scan, which means a positive enlarged lymph node or a positive lesion in the bone, and be asymptomatic and have this rising PSA despite being on a hormone therapy to lower testosterone. There's a whole group of patients who just start to have a rising PSA on that hormone-lowering therapy of the testosterone level, but yet their CAT scan and their bone scans are still negative. I've always felt, and this is, of course, just Neil Shore speaking, I'm not speaking on behalf of Dendreon, but I've always felt that that would be the ideal time to get the immunotherapy. Why wait to see a radiologic evidence when the patients could benefit even at that earlier point of the disease? Your question, which is an excellent question too, is, well, what about treating patients before they get to that androgen-independent portion of the disease, or that the castrate-resistant portion of disease where the PSA is going up? Why not treat these patients when they still are, quote, hormone-sensitive? And then you could even argue, well, why not even consider treating them if they've just had surgery, prostatectomy, or radiation, and all they have is PSA relapse? And these are great questions, and these are great studies to do. And this is important that, you know, the listeners on the program tonight get the word out for not only studies that involve Provenge, but all other aspects of prostate cancer, that we accrue patients to these trials, because it's only then will that the FDA, as well as Medicare, will broaden the label, as well as all other third-party payers, and say, oh, aha, okay, we see the data, now we'll approve it, and we'll let patients benefit from it.
Terrific. And I want to say that if there are any people who are from Dendreon on this call, and I suspect there probably are, I want you to listen to what Dr. Shore said, and please take this into consideration. Anyway, I know Provenge is administered in a way that's different than most other cancer treatments. Could you give us some idea or describe what the treatment process is like and what it is?
Sure. Well, the patients, what we have to do is begin by making sure they meet this appropriate inclusion and exclusion criteria. Basically, it's kind of healthy-appearing men who've just sort of moved along this natural progression of the disease state. And so what we do is, once we've shown that they meet that criteria in a very simple checklist in the office, the patients will receive what's known as a leukapheresis, or some people call it an apheresis, this long Greek-derived word, but it's not very complicated. All they do is go to a center. There are many of these throughout the country. Every state has multiple ones. It's oftentimes places where people might go for a dialysis treatment or for other types of blood filtration for other types of therapies, some with other cancers and sometimes with just hematologic processes that don't even involve cancer. But all a apheresis really is a piece of IV tubing in one arm on each arm, on the right side and the left side, and there's a machine that's able to filter out certain subpopulations of the white blood cells, which are then specially collected under sterile technique and then shipped off to the treatment plant where Dendreon has its manufacturing facility. The actual apheresis process requires a patient just sitting in a reclining chair, reading a book, and it takes place over about a three-hour period. There's no medication to take before or afterwards. I just encourage my patients to, stay well hydrated, drink a lot of fluids before and afterwards. And that's pretty much it. There's some admonitions about avoiding certain types of citric juices or caffeine for, a 24-hour period, but there's really quite simple. There's no anesthesia involved. There's no antibiotics required. And so the process takes 3 hours. The patient's own personalized cells, no one else's, but that patient's own personalized white blood cells, are then shipped, flown, however the quickest route is to the Dendreon manufacturing process, where his specific cells are combined with this the vaccine therapy, which creates the drug therapy known as Provenge. And this takes place about over also a 48-hour period or so. Patients at home, not hospitalized, went and got the pheresis, went home after 3 hours, and then comes back to my clinic where his specific Provenge therapy is now available. It's shipped back to my office. Patient comes in, and with another small angiocath, which we put in the arm or the hand, and the patient undergoes an infusion of now the Provenge vaccine therapy. It takes place over 60 minutes. The only medication the patient takes prior to receiving the infusion is a Benadryl and a Tylenol. And that's it. That same process is repeated 2 weeks later and one more time 2 weeks after that. So, you know, you can sort of do the math and the calendar estimate and realize that if everything goes pretty much to clockwork, it's about a 30 to 40 day overall time frame from start to beginning, but it's only really 6 days and 3 hours on three of the days and 1 hour on the other 3 days of actual patient time commitment. My patients really find that extremely appealing because, well, let's face it, most of my patients are, you know, retired, and they want to have time to do the things they like to do, whether it's, you know, golfing or hunting or visiting family or traveling. And so one of the things when I first got involved in 2003 was thinking, wow, this is a particularly appealing therapy, not only just for urologists and medical oncologists, but more importantly, very appealing to the patient that their quality of life is not impacted. And hopefully when we were doing the study, that this would really have an impact on survival. And, you know, I'm very proud and honored to have been involved in this therapy. Again, this is the only solid tumor therapeutic vaccine approved by the FDA, period. And so it's really a tremendous breakthrough in how we treat patients with not only advanced prostate cancer, but hopefully how we might be able to move that into other areas. And really the folks at Dendreon and the CEO of the company, Mitch Gold, and the chief scientific officer, Dave Erdahl, and their team that they've had over the years is to be really commended, because, you know, to get anything like this through trials and through FDA approval and Medicare negotiation and approval is a huge, huge effort, as anyone with, you know, who understands the battle of getting access to therapy and reimbursement understands.
Yeah, one of the debates that often comes up on one of our advanced prostate cancer support lines is whether to have a port installed prior to the apheresis. Could you describe what a port is, and do you think you recommend them, or what's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so sometimes patients, and I've used central ports or central line catheters, and I use them for my patients who they don't really have good veins, and the veins are typically what we describe for use are in the antecubital fossa, which is that, you know, if you bend your elbow, you straighten it out and bend it, it's that little nook in between your upper and lower arm just opposite your elbow. That's the antecubital fossa. And, of course, some people are blessed with, you know, great big ropey veins, and it's not an issue. If a patient has poor venous access, then a very simple thing to do is get a central line catheter inserted by their local interventional radiologist or their vascular surgeon, and that's typically done on an outpatient basis. It doesn't require any kind of general anesthetic. It's done with a local analgesic with a simple injection. I've had probably somewhere around, you know, 10 to maybe 15% of my patients who've required that. We arrange for visiting nurse services to come to their home and just, you know, inspect their little bandage that's on there. The catheter can be left in, you know, for, you know, 30 to 40 days as long as there's just, you know, normal good care of it and there's no signs or problems. And I've had some colleagues of mine who've had them put in and taken out and then replaced in 2 weeks later. So it really just becomes whatever the patient and physician's preference is. The main reason for doing it is simply to get access to do the phoresis and then do the ultimate infusion.
Terrific. We know that no matter what drugs or treatment we take, we're going to have side effects. I mean, we learned that very early in the prostate cancer treatment area. So what are the side effects of Provenge?
Well, the side effects of Provenge that were, you know, really most commonly reported are what are described as the infusion type of reactions. And I think it was reported in somewhere between, you know, 60 to 70% of patients in the trial. And that's typically, you know, one must remember in trials, we report everything. We're very, very careful to every single statement or complaint made by anyone is reported as it should be. In my own personal experience, I probably see these infusion reactions in about 33%, 25% of my patients. So what's an infusion reaction? It really is basically some mild flu-like symptoms, a little bit of the chills, some muscle ache, low-grade temperature. I've had a small percentage, and it lasts for about 24 hours, very rarely that it would last longer than that. I've had an occasional patient, probably about one in 8 or 10, who when they're actually getting the infusion will get some shaking chills, which is very easily treated with medication. In my own personal experience, I've never had to stop an infusion. I've never admitted a patient to the hospital for an infusion. I've never had one go to the emergency room afterwards. So I think what that really speaks to is the tolerability. In the phase 3 trial, which led to approval, the IMPACT trial, 93% of the patients completed all 3 infusions, which encompasses a course of Provenge. What that should tell you is how well tolerated the therapy actually is, you know, as opposed to traditional chemotherapies, which have many, many more side effects and toxicities.
I see. One of the other really big things that come up again and again and again is basically, how do I know Provenge is working? Many men report that despite receiving or even in between infusions, their PSA continues to go up. They have scans that show progression, and it becomes very frustrating and frightening to many of us.
Well, that is it's an emotional challenge, and in some ways it's an intellectual challenge, and it's a challenge depending upon your perspective, if you're the patient, if you're the caregiver, or if you're the clinician. And it's a very complicated issue, and I'll try to make it understandable or interpretable from my own personal experience. Many patients, regardless of therapy that's available, whether it's Provenge or even chemotherapeutics that are approved, such as docetaxel, we will oftentimes, we can see the PSA go up, the prostate-specific antigen blood tests go up, and actually the patients are not progressing clinically or radiologically. And we can also see the opposite of that. So what does that tell us? It tells us that, you know, sometimes not everything is completely true to form, and that the change in the rate of PSA is not always a perfect correlation to the clinical disease state. And we also know that there have been many other studies along the way, other drugs, other therapies, that have had impact on the PSA. PSA went down in early stage trials, phase 1, phase 2, and then they did the big phase 3 trials. The PSA came down. They may have seen some changes in bone scan and CAT scan, but at the end of the day, survival was not improved. In fact, in some studies, I'm not talking about Provenge now, I'm talking about other therapeutics that we got our hopes up on, in fact, that survival was not impacted. And when it comes to, you know, the end of the day, and when it comes to the FDA deciding upon what drugs to approve, especially and specifically in prostate cancer, overall survival is the gold standard. And so, as you brought up, with our trial, the phase three trial, the IMPACT trial, we didn't see a significant change in lowering of PSA, and we didn't see a significant change in the regression of radiologic lesions on bone and CT scan, but what we clearly saw was a statistically significant improvement on survival. So in some ways, that tells us that we need to learn more about how to follow patients with improved blood work, improved blood tests beyond PSA to let us know who are the patients who are responding well and who aren't. And I think that is something that is going to require and is getting active clinical research.
So bottom line is, I have to go by wing and a prayer, so to speak, that I'm going to have a benefit. Would that be a reasonable conclusion or not?
Well, I don't know that I would say a wing and a prayer. There is some element of validity to that statement, only in that if the PSA were just simply going up and the patient had had no change in clinical symptoms after Provenge, I do not alter my therapy. If the patient is getting a rising PSA and I get additional radiographic studies such as a bone and CT, and I see progression of disease, significant progression of disease based upon our agreed-upon definitions, what are called in the prostate cancer working group, and I can confirm that, then I might actually alter my therapy. If I see significant radiologic progression, in conjunction with PSA elevation, certainly not just for PSA elevation alone, because this flare phenomenon of PSA, we even see that with chemotherapies and other therapies as well. The most important thing, in addition to a progression radiologically, is if the patient is progressing clinically. You know, new onset of pain, loss of appetite, loss of weight, and other clinical symptoms. So the wing and the prayer, I understand where you're going with that. It's only because we're limited by a lack of what we describe as validated, accepted blood work, or specifically in the world of immunology, to let us better guide our treatment decisions. So we have to make our clinical decision to new therapy after Provenge based upon what I just described.
I see. Now, you also said that in certain circumstances you would consider changing therapy. What exactly did you mean by that?
So if the patients who are ideally suited for Provenge are, you know, early on, their PSA is going up, they're on hormonal therapy, they've now got radiologic evidence of disease with a positive lesion on bone or CT scan that doesn't include the liver, doesn't include the brain or the lungs, but just as swollen lymph nodes. And if the patient, you know, I felt was clinically progressing, clear evidence of burgeoning disease radiologically and or change and worsening of symptoms, in my patient population, I would offer that patient either a clinical trial, and we have other clinical trials, or I would offer them the standard of care, which is at that point for symptomatic patients, that would be docetaxel, also known as Taxotere.
Would you at the same time continue the Provenge treatment if they were, say, not completed with the three infusions?
Well, you know, you probably haven't selected your patient carefully enough if during the course of the 30 to 40 days that the patient was receiving his Provenge that they started to become symptomatic. You know, ideally we want to identify patients who are far away from being symptomatic in that 30 to 40-day period. again, I really do think that patients are going to be best suited who are discovered earlier, which brings up a very, very important point. It's incumbent upon the listening audience, once they have that rising PSA, despite being on a hormone-lowering agent such as Lupron or Eligard or Degarelix known as Firmagon or Trelstar or Vantus, if your PSA is going up and you've got to talk to your urologist or your medical oncologist, more likely than not you're still seeing the urologist. You've got to talk to them and say, hey, how do we know where I am in terms of my overall disease state? Then if you haven't had a bone scan in a reasonable period of time in the last year or two, and certainly a CAT scan, it may be a very good time to get one or both of those tests. And then based upon the rate of rise of the PSA, or what we call the PSA velocity or the PSA doubling time, or even an absolute level, certainly over, you know, 8 or 10, would be very reasonable to repeat those scans. Because we want to find the patient who, again, is asymptomatic, but now has a lower volume of disease before they start to become symptomatic. Because I think that we want to avoid the steroids and the cytotoxic chemotherapeutics for as long as possible so as not to have any risk of impacting on the immunologic benefit of Provenj. Remember, Provenj is designed to re-educate or stimulate or better to potentiate the patient's own native white blood cells known as the T cells.
I see. Okay. I'm going to move on to what's probably a more inflamed area. And there's been a lot of negative press and there's been a lot of conversation about the significant cost of Provenj and when that gets for many people measured against the 4.1 months that it extends survival, people are asking a question, is it worth it? And I was wondering if you had a perspective on that.
Well, you know, I do have a perspective for sure. And I look at my perspective is that of somebody who's been, you know, treating patients with advanced prostate cancer since I've gotten out of my residency now for a full 20 years. I finished my residency at Sloan Kettering and Cornell New York Hospital in 1990. And I can tell you that when you've been diagnosed and you had your prostatectomy or your radiation and you're unfortunately in the 20 to 30% of men who fail, you don't fail and succumb to the disease in a matter of a couple of years. It's typically, you know, could be 5 to 10 to 12 years. And so you can live with prostate cancer for a long period of time. You've been on the hormone ablative therapies, and now you're developing that resistant state. PSA is going up, and you've got a positive lesion. What I've been bothered by is watching too many men die of prostate cancer. And it's a traditional race between, you know, the urologists and medical oncologists against the cardiologist. We don't want our patients dying of cancer. We want everybody to die of old age. Old age is somewhat of a euphemism, I think, for cardiovascular disease. But having said that, I think that when the patients can get a therapy that is extremely well tolerated, that doesn't end up in the emergency room, and that doesn't end up in the hospital, that's an interesting or additional correlation costs that we might see with other therapies, the traditional chemotherapies, where the patients can have lowering of their white blood cells, they get prone to infections, other complications of diarrhea, etc. When you factor in those issues, the cost of care, hospitalization, emergency room visits can go up very significantly in addition to the ancillary drugs that we oftentimes have to give patients on chemotherapy. Suffice it to say, Joel, I mean, these things cost money, and I wish everybody can get these therapies for free, right? But as you know, I'm fond of telling my son, there is no money tree in the backyard. We have to pay for these therapies. And the land of innovation, of research and development, is the United States. And, you know, I can only look at a company like Gendron that took over a decade and over $1 billion to get a product to market, and it could have all failed. So there is an issue of recuperation of that time and effort. Now, when it comes to the cost of therapies, I've read things on, you know, the cost of other – there are some other therapies out there for systemic disease that are much more costly, and there's some that are less costly. As a clinician and someone who's seen, you know, men die of prostate cancer, if I can offer the patient a therapy that is not going to impact on their quality of life but extend the overall quantity of their life, I think it's a great thing. You know, the bigger issues about, you know, how our country and government's going to continue to pay for therapies is very controversial, and I don't think there are any easy answers to that.
Right. Well, I mean, just to share my stripes, I'm 100% in agreement with you, and as a matter of fact, I actually did an analysis of the cost of the extra survival time for Provenge versus the survival time for Taxotere, and I actually conclude that the cost per month of extra survival time on Taxotere, a drug that no one questions, is actually more expensive when you add in all the ancillary costs. And if anybody's interested in reading that analysis, it is on the Advanced Prostate Cancer blog, which is at advancedprostatecancer.net. But anyway, so much for that. The other thing I find that there's a lot of confusion about is what does the 4.1 months survival, the median, actually mean? I know you're not a statistician, but I think that people get hung up on the statistics. Would you be comfortable talking a little bit about what that actually means and what a median is and things in that order to maybe help clarify some of that? Are you able to do that?
Sure. So what the median means is that at any point in time, 50% of the patients, there were at the median, if you look at the graphs, that you see the separation of the curves of the patients who received Provenge versus those who didn't. It's a little more complicated than that because about two-thirds of the patients who originally got a placebo actually went on to get what was called a frozen product of Provenge, not the actual product that one would get today. So there was even two-thirds, if not more, of the patients in the placebo arm actually went on to get another version of Provenge, which some have argued is clearly not as potentially efficacious as what one can get today. But having said that, there was, at the median, 50% of the patients had a 4.1 month survival advantage. Well, you say 4.1 months, but you have to remember, and you really like to have my dialogue in terms of months. I tend to think more in terms of percentages, because what that means, that's just 50% of the group. There could be patients, above that who might have had an 8 or 10 month survival advantage. And of course, there may have been some who had such aggressive disease that they might have been less than 4 months. Another way of thinking about this is if you talk to medical oncologists, there have probably been only two or three other drugs in all of medical oncology, all tumors, all malignancies, that have had at least a four-month or more improvement. Now, we have to put this in the perspective that these are patients, and maybe many of the listeners or some portion of the listeners, who have been battling this disease for a long period of time. And if we do nothing, the average life expectancy for someone who has asymptomatic advanced or metastatic castrate-resistant prostate cancer can be about 18 to 20 months. Well, if I, had 18 to 20 months and somebody looked at me and said, I've got something that's going to give you an extra 4 months on top of your 18 months, that's an enormous benefit. It's not about the 4 months of survival advantage from when you were newly diagnosed. This is about a 4 month advantage when the pace of the disease is really starting to take off. And it's a 4 month median survival advantage with a very short duration of therapy, only 30 to 40 days, that's extremely well tolerated. So my hope is that not only will patients benefit from Provenge if given, you know, as early as possible, making sure their physicians are getting the scans, checking their PSA to make sure they meet enrollment criteria, but that they can benefit at some point also from appropriate use of chemotherapy, absolutely. As you mentioned, there's cabazitaxel or Gemtana, which is a second-line chemotherapy which has been approved. There are other oral drugs. There's this drug abiraterone, which is approved also after progression from Taxotere. And we're working on so many other therapies, both oral and intravenous, to give earlier on in the disease state. So the big hope is that we make this a truly a chronic disease, much like having high blood pressure or diabetes.
I see. Thank you so much. Since you've been involved in the trials, phase three trials early on, are you still seeing men who were in those trials who are still alive today?
Yes, I still have, again, the phase three trial finished, well over almost the exact date would probably be over 3 years ago. And the answer is yes. And I have patients now who are receiving therapy who have received their course of the three infusions and, are not only look remarkably healthy, but are acting remarkably healthy. And I think that's what's so exciting, about, the drug and therapeutic developments now in prostate cancer. And our challenge as the clinician treating community is better understanding how to sequence and how to combine all these new therapies. And honestly, we don't have all the answers, as we started talking about earlier. We need to, work collaboratively, all the different specialties, the urologists, medical oncologists, radiation oncologists, and collaboratively with industry. And industry is anxious and willing to work collaboratively. We need to work collaboratively with our government, the NIH and NCI-funded grants. We need to work collaboratively with the academic centers and the community centers where many of the patients are. And I think it's advocacy groups like MailCare who really are the glue for all of these organizations that I just mentioned that helps bring everybody together and says, hey, wait a second, here's an unanswered question, here's an unmet need, this is what needs to be addressed.
Thank you. Do you see a difference in African-American, Asian, and Caucasian men that come to see you as far as their nature of their cancer and how they respond to treatment, including Provenge?
So that is an excellent question. There is unfortunately in this country a disparity amongst the African-American population in terms of their mortality rates. It's regarding specifically for prostate cancer. It's really unconscionable that in the southeast of which or an area where I am, South Carolina, in particular, as well as the District of Columbia and Washington, D.C., and metropolitan areas in the north, the mortality rates of African Americans with prostate cancer is nearly doubled to all non-African American groups. And it's a complex, multifactorial issue. Part of it has to do with not appropriate enough use of screening. A bigger part of it, and I think a less controversial part, has to do with African Americans not getting access to clinical trials. And there's a whole bunch of reasons why that may have happened. There's some historical problems about African Americans being abused in clinical trials, and now there's some issues in terms of just getting out information to the African American community. But regarding Provenge, we did an analysis after the conclusion of the phase three trial. And so we call this a post hoc or after the fact analysis, which is kind of looking at things in the retro spectroscope, which one can argue is not as valid as if you designed a study to look at it prospectively. But having said that, and with the small numbers of patients in the PROVENGE trial, there was an unbelievably positive response of African-American men in terms of an even wider improvement or separation of the curves impacting overall survival even more favorably in African-American men. Now, that work is incredibly thought-provoking and needs to be verified and validated with more studies. But there is clearly more we need to understand from genetics and other markers amongst African Americans, perhaps the Asian community, the Latin community, the traditional Caucasian communities, and finding out what are the markers, what are the variances that can identify somebody who would be a great responder versus somebody who might not be.
I see. One of the exclusions on the phase 3 trials were HIV/AIDS. If someone was HIV/AIDS positive, they were not allowed to enter into the trial. Can you tell us why that was the case?
Yeah, that's a good question. And, you know, one of the challenges right now, and, boy, I hope someone from CMS is listening to this broadcast. I suspect they're not. But, you know, if I had somebody who was HIV positive and had had no clinical evidence of disease right now from HIV but was in complete remission and been in that for a long, prolonged period of time, who unfortunately also happened to have a criteria to get PROVENGE, I might have a really hard time giving it to that person because the third-party payers or even CMS might say, well, we have no data on those patients. Patients tend to get excluded in trials because you're just trying to get a specific population of patients to meet an accrual pool, and oftentimes some arbitrary decisions are made. I think at the time HIV patients may have been felt to be immunocompromised. They may have been felt to have a less likelihood of a significant survival and that their prostate cancer wouldn't cause them an untimely death in comparison to their HIV. Similarly, we had some other criteria regarding elevated liver function tests. And I think, to be very candid and blunt about it, I think some of these exclusion criteria, and these are the exclusion criteria as opposed to the inclusion, are arbitrary and don't make a lot of clinical sense. And it's just an unfortunate limitation that some patients who have these exclusionary criteria based upon a trial might not be able to benefit in the real world now, even despite FDA approval. And we either need to do those studies in those subpopulations of patients, or perhaps there just needs to be more lobbying and advocacy on behalf of those patients.
Well, obviously that's a task for Mail Care, and it's also a task, again, if anyone from Dendrion is listening, we need you to do that. I was wondering, in your practice, have you ever had a patient identify themselves as being gay or a transgender?
I have a reasonable amount of gay patients with prostate cancer. It's certainly not the majority, but I have had many patients who have identified themselves as gay with prostate cancer. I have not had a transgender patient.
Is that when someone identifies himself as gay, do you change your treatment plans, or what do you do to accommodate any differences there may be?
I don't do anything different other than encourage them to, if they have a partner, to make sure they bring in their partner, because partner support is, whether it's, you know, a female spouse or a male partner, is extremely important. So oftentimes I think for the gay population, there's reluctance to bring in their partners, and I encourage that very strongly. But in terms of my clinical treatment options, in terms of my therapeutic options, there's absolutely no difference.
Okay, good. Since you do work with men who are in end stage, that must be mighty difficult. How do you deal with that? How do you keep yourself grounded when you're dealing with them, and what sort of things can you do or do you try to do with them?
Well, that's a double-edged sword in that these patients actually are some of the most the patients who are really getting close towards further and further progression. It's some of the most absolutely rewarding and emotionally gratifying times of being a physician that one can imagine. As we get closer and closer to the end of life, we take a lot of pride in my clinic, and particularly my research nurses and my nurses who work with me and have known these men and their families for a long period of time. It's a remarkably rewarding and gratifying experience to work with patients, talk with patients, hold their hands, laugh with them and cry with them as they get to a progression of their disease state. It's a remarkably gratifying experience to have, and it's truly an honor as a physician. And at the same time, when you lose someone, as I'm sure many of the listeners have, whether it's from cancer or from anything else, loss of a loved one is an agonizing experience, and it can be something that certainly one may never get fully over. But it's a real privilege, I think, to be involved with that. I think that in terms of our philosophy, and I think what we're doing, starting to do a better job in U.S. healthcare overall, is addressing the issues and not shunning the conversation and the discussion about fear of both the patient and the patient's family, and addressing the issues and issues of pain, issues of possible death. Many physicians are extremely uncomfortable in talking about it. We've done a poor job in our medical education system of discussing death. We don't like to discuss it as a culture, but it is quite a natural process. And if you have always the opportunity to offer hope and encouragement, which we certainly try to do, as well as avoidance of toxicity of therapy, that's, I think, about all you can do, and just be there. Sometimes just being there is equally important.
Yeah, that's good. Are you at all familiar with some of the other immunological therapies that are currently in trial for treating advanced prostate cancer?
Yes, it's an incredibly exciting time. It's just a wonderful, wonderful time. I mean, like I said, in the last year we had, four FDA-approved therapies since 2010 of April, as you mentioned them earlier, Provenj, Jeftana, Xgeva, known as denosumab, and then Zytiga, abiraterone. We have several other very interesting immunotherapies that are out there. One is called ipilimumab. It's being trialed in prostate cancer. It was just successfully trialed and approved for patients with metastatic melanoma. And I think its trade name is Yergoy, Yergoy. We also have some other therapeutic vaccines that are being trialed. One is also known as Prostvac, and it's years away from completing its trial, let alone getting approved. But it works differently from Provenge, as does ipilimumab. These are different mechanisms of action. And what I love about that is these different immunotherapeutics, they're not going to be me-too drugs, okay? It's not going to be another, it's not Bayer versus Anacin aspirin. These are immunotherapeutics that are designed to re-stimulate, you know, better involve our native immune system with going at it at different pathways. So isn't that exciting if you have advanced disease that you could have not just one but two or possibly three other ways of stimulating one's immune system to fight the cancer?
So we need to have you keep us alive so we can have a chance to sample all of these treatments.
Well, that's it, right? And well, you know, and it's not just about staying alive. It's staying alive with good quality of life and being able to do the things that one worked hard to do in one's life. And so it's a great time. I think, you know, just to, not to, you know, to bring it back, it's sort of a scary time in that here we are. We're not on the cusp. We're right in the thick of understanding the different molecular pathways that cause advanced cancer. And progression of cancer, but yet we are hitting a point right now where we're at this economic challenge, aren't we? So we have all these new therapies that are getting approved and more to be approved, and yet we're suddenly, you know, backing up against how are we going to, you know, handle the compensation for all of these things. So we don't want to be shortchanged on it. We have to be out there fighting for patients with prostate cancer, because all the other organizations, whether it, and they're good and they're great noble causes, whether it's cardiovascular disease or HIV/AIDS or breast cancer, or you know, even non-malignant entities, organizations like MailCare and others and patient advocates have to be out there making sure that, you know, we continue to get the resources and the funding to do these studies and take, and not only do the studies, but also to pay for the therapies that ultimately get approved.
And, of course, based on the political times, this is more important than it's ever been, so I reiterate that. It's common practice when someone's diagnosed with breast cancer to be referred for genetic counseling. I have never, ever met a man who's been diagnosed with prostate cancer that's ever been told to get genetic counseling. Is there a reason? Should a man with prostate cancer get genetic counseling? And what would the benefits be for him?
Well, it's a hotbed of research, and there are some companies out there that are looking into that genetic analysis. There's no doubt about it. There's multiple companies, none that I am aware of that have received an FDA approval or at least a Medicare CMS approval for compensation. This testing tends to be very expensive. What we do know is that men who have first-degree relatives, a father, a brother, even potentially second degree, a grandfather, who had a diagnosis of prostate cancer that was clinically impactful, are at higher risk, and that there is a genetic predisposition for certain men with prostate cancer, especially if your father was diagnosed at an earlier age, or you have brothers or multiple, you know, cousins and uncles. There clearly appears to be a genetic predisposition. We even know that in African-American men, there's a potential predisposition for the development of the disease at a younger point in time. But yet we also appreciate that there may be clearly dietary and nutritional factors that increase one's risk for prostate cancer. Japanese, of Asian descent and upbringing have a very low risk of prostate cancer. When they come over to Western culture, Japanese Americans, their prostate cancer incidence goes up significantly, to suggest dietary and or environmental factors. But you're right. There is no reflex genetic testing in prostate cancer like we do for breast. It still needs to be worked out a little bit more. I think it will be something that we'll be seeing in the future.
Terrific. Actually, I'm looking at my clock, and we're 10 minutes over our hour already, and I actually have a bunch of questions that people have asked. So if it would be okay with you, could I forward those questions to you by email, and you could perhaps give an answer, and then I can send them back to the people, since I really don't want to spend more time answering these because we are so late?
I'd be happy to.
I appreciate that. And I guess the last final question I'd like to ask you is, what do you see in the future for men who are diagnosed with prostate cancer? Here's a chance to give a good global summary.
So newly diagnosed with prostate cancer, we need to do a much better job of recognizing and advising our patients on who has the more aggressive disease that would benefit from aggressive therapy versus the patients who have an unaggressive disease or a low-risk disease that don't need to be overburdened with localized therapies, whether it's surgical or radiation or freezing, and leave those patients alone. Having said that, that would save a lot of morbidity in terms of impacting on patients' quality of life to avoid unnecessary overtreatment. What I've been most interested in is the patients who have the more aggressive disease who we fail to treat as successfully locally. And it's this population where Provenge and other novel therapeutics will allow these men to live into their, you know, late 70s, 80s, and 90s as if they didn't have prostate cancer. I think we're getting there. Clearly, Provenge is a huge step in that direction. Newer chemotherapies, newer oral targeted agents. I would love to be able to finish my career knowing that the risk of dying of advanced prostate cancer is very, very small, and patients will ultimately succumb to, you know, the typical old age phenomenon, or just, you know, your ticker just doesn't have any more ticks to it, and that's okay, as long as we can do it in such a way that patients continue to maintain good quality of life, then I think we've done our job as a medical profession.
Dr. Shore, I want to thank you for taking your personal time to share your knowledge with us this evening. And for those people who might be interested in making an appointment to see Dr. Shore, you can contact him at 1-877-809-8719. And again, for those people who are listening, MailCare will continue to bring other teleconferences on the hot topics facing us. Check in with the MailCare website, and we will also send notices to people who have registered. Again, thank you, Dr. Shore, and thank you, everyone else, for listening in. Have a good evening.